We are all human. That means there is something about our experience that is the same. Otherwise, we would not all be human. We would not even be able to communicate. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Pat.
Yeah.
Will.
Hey.
And Jason.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
Today we're looking at the last two rules of Jordan Peterson's Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life. So that's rule 11 and 12. Do not allow yourself to become resentful, deceitful, or arrogant. And rule 12, be grateful in spite of your suffering. So my first question to the group and to anybody out there listening on YouTube or Anchor or wherever you found this podcast, what is the world made of? Whoever wants to jump in and however you want to take that question. Let's start with you, Pat.
Okay, here's my answer. It's a vague question to ask because there's so many things to go around that question. I mean, I can answer, you know, the quote or maybe explore that a little bit.
Yeah, well, he gives you a few answers in the book, you know. Like, it really depends on your outlook. Like, you could answer with atoms. You could answer with story. You could answer with God. You could answer with, like, the spiritual or material. Or you could answer with potential. And they're all the correct answer. So which one's your favorite, Pat?
Well, my favorite part about Rule 11 is just going to the origins of yourself, because just like the title itself, in order to understand where arrogance and deceit and degeneracy comes from, we have to dive deeply into ourselves first before we go on with the world and traverse it. And so, and the way you do that is, it's kind of like working with children in a way where you try to understand what they're seeing and getting an idea of whatever it is that they are looking at and communicating through that. And the best way to do that is to present them with stories like Pinocchio, because Peterson brings up Pinocchio many times. Right. And it's a way of how much depth children perceive in these stories. And even us adults can. But the thing is, they can spot things that are not very noticeable to adults. They can just take a look at something specifically and then internalize it and then, in a way, reenact it the way they see it. And it's almost like, you know, their own drama, their own stage, their own play. And it's a really interesting way because last weekend I went out of town to visit my little nephew, and the way he's been viewing cartoons, like he started watching American Tail, you know, Fievel, the character Fievel, and he's been looking at very strange details. Like, he wanted me to rewind a certain scene over and over again, like, you know, whenever they sing or whatever. And I kept looking at that and thinking, what is he actually looking at? And then to this day, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. But just to go through that kind of situation, it's almost internal too. It's, just something that comes out of whatever their mind is, and then just presenting it through a type of medium, like movies and cartoons and things like that.
So your answer, your answer is story then, or at least like a story brings out whatever the world is made out of.
Yeah.
Into something like perceivable by the rest of us.
And it's interesting you mentioned, you know, the Fievel Goes West movie, because, you know, there's something out there potential, and it's kind of one of the main songs from that movie. I remember being a kid, and as you're a kid, you know, your brain's not quite as plastic, or it is more plastic, so you can perceive and go with the flow a bit more, and life feels more like a story and a drama, and you see yourself as some kind of character in that story. And I remember being a kid and watching that movie about Fievel Goes West, and it's kind of what they're talking about in this chapter, how there's potential, the same potential that people saw when they went west. And in that story, when you don't have a home, and you know, you're out there confronting nature and confronting the unknown, and
you're seeing things for what they are, that you're seeing some of the good things and the bad things and the tyrannical things and even the lessons that come with it.
I think I'm going to say maybe the world's made of focus, or whatever the byproduct of focus is, because that's still chunked up high enough that it's semi-meaningless and also enlightening, insightful. It's like, you know, if you look at it through like atoms and other sciencey things that are the things that make the things, then it's like those focused specific groups of molecules and structures that become desk, become person, become planet, become, you know, something that has gravity and affects other things. And then if you zoom in deep enough to like the human level, I think, you know, if you don't know that the world is made of stories, then your focus is so into your own story that you might say, you know, the world is just made of shit. Or you might say, well, it's all love and joy and divine creation in every single thing. And, you know, you get all of your array of human emotion and experience and perception through the name focus. I think that's what I'm going with.
Well, that can tie into, like, what you focus on is, like, what part of the world you see, because Jordan Peterson brings up the seven archetypes, right? Like the two archetypes of culture, the two archetypes of nature, and then the two archetypes within the self. So it starts with culture being like the wise king and the authoritarian tyrant. That's like the masculine element. And then nature being the evil queen, or the fairy godmother being the feminine, you know, element of it. And then the self is divided between the hero and the adversary. And then the seventh is just the dragon of chaos. So the complete unknown. So that's another answer of what the world is made out of. And then your focus really determines your character and like the kind of world you see. And he talks about like the environmentalists, and if you only see the fairy godmother and the authoritarian tyrant, then you see like the masculine element oppressing the like the benevolent feminine element of nature. So you really have to be able to see that there's good and evil in both sides. And I love the example that Jordan Peterson brings up when he says, you know, in Canada, half the year, you know, the elements are trying to kill us. Two more months of the year, the bugs are trying to kill us. So nature isn't just a fairy godmother up here. And you really have to pay attention to realize that.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like, and even in the cities, right? Like, if you go into a big enough human hive, like, we've won the battle against nature for the most part. Like, you look at Toronto in the middle of winter, it's a completely different land than, you know, the rest of the province. There's, like, five cities that maybe don't have the same experience we have. And when they get the snow, they don't even know what to do with it.
Yeah, they have to call in the military some years.
And I think if you don't know, like, that there are archetypes, if you don't have the understanding of options, if you don't have an open mind, if you don't have awareness of the way things could be, then, you know, your focus is going to keep getting more and more focused on the thing that you think to be the thing. And so if you think, you know, government is inherently evil, and you focus on that, and you go out of your way, you know, to make sure that you can prove to the world that this is the way it is, like, your brain at an unconscious level is just going to keep zooming in deeper and deeper and finding more and more atrocious proof and evidence of what you think is the reality. And I'm not saying it is or isn't, because there's a lot more to consider. Like, there's a lot of bad and there's a lot of good, and that's a lot of useless in a 9-to-5 Monday to Friday lifestyle. And you've got to be able to be in a few different gears, right? Because it's so easy to get to paycheck day and not make any impact on the world, and not volunteer, and not donate to charity, and not engage with the bigger issues and the flip side of reality, which is, like, you're in society and you're not just a little worker ant. Like, you have the capacity to do more.
And I think that's where the resentment comes in. Just focusing on one path, and that whatever it is coming from your unconsciousness, if you focus on that daily, then that's what brings out the deceit in you and begins to spread. It becomes like clusters and everything. And I think it also brings, like, existential dread too. It not only, whenever you present your ideas to the world, like how terrible it is and everything, not only are you, like, passing on this kind of bad rhetoric or this, you know, dramatic form of resentment towards other people, you're also emptying yourself. Like, you're sucking yourself dry by presenting this type of narrative to the world. And maybe in the long run, you might persuade a lot of people to join you. And, you know, if there is something to offer, then you can develop a following. But for the most part, it's somewhat unproductive if you do that.
And it's exactly what you said. I think the way I'm interpreting it, because it's like there's only so many hours in a day, right? Like, you've got two choices. Are you going to engage in this rhetoric or that rhetoric? Are you going to do the dishes, or are you going to put them off? Like, because tomorrow's coming, and it's coming up real quick. And if you look back on the last 30 days and ask yourself, you know, how many times did I have a conversation where my intent was to inspire more acts of kindness and good in the world, versus how many times did I have a conversation where I complained about the situation of my life and the context of the world that I am perceiving? It might be an interesting reflection.
I just think it's interesting. Scott brought up the vision of the world and how you perceive it, and how significant it is, maybe, that on the first page of this chapter, there's Satan, who is, you know, the fallen angel, and it's like how not to let yourself fall into resentment and deceit and arrogance. And he's kind of a poster boy for that character. And I also had this quote running around my head, though, from Albert Einstein. It's a question, you know, how do you perceive the universe? Is it friendly? And I think how you answer that, how you approach that, changes your perspective and how you see or envision potential, how you picture the story playing out in front of you. Because if you feel that the universe is unfriendly, there's going to be a certain narrative there, versus if the universe is benevolent.
Well, and it's like we've got this spectrum of perception where, you know, from unfriendly to friendly, we've got the victim to the almost dissociated, you know, oh, the universe is friendly and everything is perfect, and they just have completely put themselves not at guard. And then somewhere in the middle, you know, you've got, like, preppers who are like, could be either way, but I got myself a shotgun.
Right. So, like, I mean, so in the drama of life, you kind of ask yourself, do you see yourself as this hero or adversary? Which I think he goes more into in the next chapter, The Last Rule. But I like how in this Rule 23, he goes into the dichotomy between how you view nature Is it friendly or unfriendly? How do you view culture? Is it the, you know, military industrial complex, or is it like a system that's, you know, putting order to the chaos of nature?
Yeah, like, it's easy to look at the government and say they're tearing us apart, but we really don't look at the other side of the coin. Like, if the government wasn't there at all, would we have a reason to talk to each other at all? Would we have a reason to get along at all? Would we have any kind of connection? Because, like, the guy from the next city over would be the equivalent to, like, another country, right? So it does bring some source of unity in that sense.
What? I almost, the way I started to, like, I'm young. I have no idea how the world works, and I'm just starting to read these books and start to change my focus and widen the lens. And it's like, so we were driving into this town the other day, and it's like incorporated 1909. And I was like, wait a second. If a town's incorporated, that means it's a business. What? And so now it's like I'm at this point where it's like, you know, you've got public business and then private business, and there's this push and pull, and they're both trying to sort of provide law and stability to man and sort of get, like, squash anarchy. And theoretically, you know, through those mechanisms, they're actually harnessing chaos in nature. And it's not so much that they're trying to make order of the nature, but that they're using the energy of nature, hopefully in an effective manner, to sort of fuel the industry of combating anarchy and creating peace and stability in the world. And it's like red versus blue and public versus private. And, you know, like, it's real nice to have a private boat launch, but it's real handy to move to a new town and see that there's a public boat launch.
Well, it's kind of like what Scott said. We have to be able to see another side of the same coin and just see where some of the benefits are and what we can bring to our lives, essentially, instead of just being holed up with one side.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking you could have a boat ramp or you could not have a boat ramp. Like, there's the potential either way, right? So I see the potential they give between the two types of nature. The characters there are the evil queen and the fairy godmother. They are representative of nature. So nature could go one way or the other. And then for culture, you have the benevolent kind king and the authoritarian. So it could go one way or the other. There's potential in either direction. And then for yourself, you know, you have the hero or adversary. Are you the hostile brother or are you the good guy?
Right. And I think to be, like, fully balanced, you need both sides of all of them and a healthy relationship with the Dragon of Chaos at the end. Like, I don't think you get very far with only seeing culture as the wise king or the authoritarian tyrant, because, like, if you think that one of them is the right answer, you start turning into a conspiracy theorist or something. You lose sight of the bigger picture as a whole. You actually lose the ability to see, like, the good side of culture if you just focus on tearing it all down all the time and you don't even try to acknowledge the benefits that it gives you. You know, like the old cliche of the socialist communist kid living in California tweeting about communism on his iPhone, right?
Yeah, perspective. There's a lot of stuff hidden in the fog, and I think that that's a big, variable in resentment and arrogance and lack of grace. Like, there is so much that we repress and delete in our existence that we take for granted, that we are just completely blind, like unwillfully blind to so much of reality that it's so easy to slip into the blame game and say, you know what, I'm being affected by the world and I can't cause anything to happen. And so I'm going to blame this nominalization of a construct that I perceive as the source of all that is evil in my world.
Yeah, and then that that flows right into the third dichotomy. Like, you have to see both sides of nature, you have to see both sides of culture, and you have to see both sides of yourself. Like, yeah, sure, there's the part of you that's the hero. You can acknowledge that you're on your own path, you're taking the hero's journey, but there's also that part of you. Like, it is you that is the adversary. It's you. You're the little voice inside your head that says, now put it off. I'll do it tomorrow. I don't have to work out today. I don't have to write today. I don't have to, you know, work on my website or whatever your passion is, whatever it is you're working on. You're always going to want to put it off or, you know, try to just do something else. And that's the adversary coming through right there.
And it's not just that. It's also the, oh, this isn't a dragon. This is fine. I can do this behavior. I can do this habit. I can do this. I can do that. This isn't a dragon. This isn't a dragon. Then suddenly you wake up 10 years later and you're like, why am I so burnt out?
Well, that little shadow that you thought was just a little kitty cat, well, that was actually a dragon. So you got to take care of that now.
You got burnt.
Yeah.
There's also kind of a subtle aspect, a second character behind the dragon itself, because the dragon represents the complete unknown. But he says that there's a treasure possibly waiting in that unknown. So there's a dragon kind of guarding this treasure. And if you are just completely afraid of the dragon and won't confront what you don't know, there's no possibility of ever even looking at that treasure.
Yeah, that's just always the constant attribute of the dragon itself, is it's always guarding the treasure.
Right. There might be
it's
like
always
complete
worth something.
Pandemonium behind the, you know, the blind corner, but there could also be like a pot full of gold.
It's interesting because Jordan Peterson talks a lot about how, you know, when we're learning, we learn through stories and through narratives. And my wife was playing The Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker a week or two ago.
Classic.
And she got to, right? such a good game. 5 out of 5. And she gets to the island that you get from the school teacher, and the door has a person on it. It's got like a butler, and he's like, get your dirty hands off of me. You're not the owner of the place. And then you have to like show him the deed to the house. And he's like, oh, a deed to the house. You're the new master. I see and respect you as the master. You may enter. And it's like, looking at it now, I'm like, oh, this is a really intelligent system to, you know, convey to a child how deeds work. And as a child, I was like, well, this is weird. I better get the deed. And that was it. But what I was thinking about was that, you know, there's not a lot of stories and video games where money was personified. You know, it was always just like, okay, you enter the game, you destroy the bushes, you get the rupees, because money is everything and you always need it. It's ever present and it is the way that you get stuff. And you need a bigger wallet and you need to stack it up. And then in The Hobbit, there's the dragon sickness on the money.
Right. Like, going back to the rupee wallets in The Legend of Zelda, I think it's a really cool game mechanic that you have to earn the bigger size wallets, you know? Like, you start out, you only got the junior size bank account. You can only carry 99 rupees. That's it. And then you have to earn the ability. You have to learn the value of a rupee. You have to learn the value of a dollar to get the bigger wallet. And like, you don't truly understand what that money means until, you know, what, the next shield is 6,000 rupees? I can only carry 999. I need to upgrade here.
And not to mention, same thing applies in Majora's Mask, where you have to save the money before the moon crashes. That's something you have to keep in mind too.
That's a good parable for life, you know. Save your money before the moon crashes. What I was thinking with... No, I was being cynical. It wasn't a good parable, bro. With Thorin in The Hobbit, I think it's interesting because it isn't even a personification of the money. It's still not the money that's making him sick. It's the dragon that has hoarded the money, that has left its dragon's sickness on the money. And he slays the dragon, and he postures himself as though he's the one that vanquished the dragon, and it's his loot, and he did it on his own, and he turns into this tyrant for a minute. And it's like, no one slays a dragon on their own. And if you think you did, you're going to fall into a slippery slope.
Yeah, maybe it's because he didn't have that incremental improvement. Like, he went straight from 99 rupees straight to a billion. He didn't get the 999, then 9,000, then, you know, up and up and up until you get, he was a lowly traveler, then he was a billionaire.
Well, and boom, you've got a metaphor for fame and how it affects the psyche of someone who rises to prominence overnight. And you've got a huge takeaway for people who just do not understand the effects of the dragon that is the monetary system. Take it as the thing that is the problem, blame it, call it inherently evil, and forget about the entire story and the narrations that have been developing us for thousands of years. Like, no, actually, there's a whole bigger picture here, and it's not just one thing.
Right.
One of the other things that is brought up is how we interact with this reality, right? So Jordan positions that we are interacting with the future through language, right? And in the video games, like you brought up The Legend of Zelda, you interact as a character through dialogue, through scripts. You get to choose what your action is going to be and what you're going to say. And I'm kind of thinking that when you have lots of money, you've gathered a large treasure, your the influence of what you have to say is greater, right? So it kind of would make sense that you want to collect this money because it gives you a voice, an amplifier for what you might have to say.
Well, literally, so in another video game, MapleStory, so we enter the MMORPG world, you could literally monetarily invest in your character and buy a megaphone that would blast what you had to say across every channel and on your world, right? So, like, everybody heard what you had to say. And if you spent even more money, you could make it, like, take up screen real estate on everybody's screen unavoidably. And it was a message system. And it's like, if you're rich, everyone can hear what you have to say. You just have to pay for it.
You could do that just to say, I'm rich!
Yeah. And what ends up happening is the weirdest thing. You know, people just give away the permission and they offer up free megaphones for people to say whatever they want. And what do these people do? They win the contest and they say, oh, you know, make a post that says happy birthday to my friend. And it's just like this lovely exchange. People have conversations on the world stage. They meet people and form bigger communities around themselves while they're on the game. But then, you know, the media doesn't do the same thing.
Oh, why is that?
It's the adversary.
There are some wholesome corners of the media, but if you don't even know that there's a birthday page or you know, letters to the editor page. Like, there's so many columns that existed on a newspaper that was so valuable, such a great technology that's gone now. And, you know, if you just have Facebook for your news, oof.
Yeah, I mean, having language as the mode that we interact with the world around us is kind of significant because he goes into this whole chapter on sins of commission and how telling lies, for example, if you are a rich, not that there's anything wrong with being rich, but if you are like a company owner, an executive, and you brag about not paying your taxes, for example, it's that would be kind of a sin of commission, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But before we go there, hold on. I want to say one more thing about this whole thing about having stories and different stuff. It'd be like, imagine, you know, you've got 999 TV channels, which is like all of the different stories of what the world is made of. But you don't know that they exist. You don't have a remote. You don't have a TV guide. And you're born into Fox News. Or you're born into Treehouse, which is like a kid's TV channel up in Canada. I don't know if you guys have it down there. Or like just National Public Radio. You know what I mean? Like, this is your one channel. And you've got for 25 years and 50 years and 75 years. And you don't even know that there's like 998 other options. Like, that could be your world. And that would be terrible.
Yeah, for us it was the CBC, right, Will?
Yeah. Yeah, Gaza Strip.
Yeah, and that kind of realization, well, it's kind of like what we were going by, what we were saying earlier, which is, you know, the more information we have, the more, you know, it becomes overloaded and we don't know what to do with ourselves. We develop anxiety and then eventually we develop a sense of dread. And the more we see that, the more this existential danger sets in. Because we don't know what to pick, and if we do, then, you know, it'll just create even more anxieties. And to become, to add on what Jason mentioned, with sense of commission, it's always going to be based on appearances. And there have been many charlatans throughout history that have done this, which is they want to gather a crowd around by mentioning a product or an elixir or some kind of service that they provide. They don't mention it very much. It's very vague, but they make it very interesting. And it draws in the crowd and everything. And in a way, you cannot blame them for that. But at the same time, you know, they can be a bit of a, you know, they can be bad sometimes. They can be sinful for what they do. Unless they know how to understand your pain and what pleasures you're after, and if you can provide that to them, then great. But, yeah, it's just based on appearances and what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's this notion of garbage in, garbage out that gets mentioned in this chapter. And I think that kind of addresses what you were talking about, Will and Pat, about if you're only getting a limited spectrum of the possible wavelengths that are out there, your signal's not good enough to really make an informed decision. And that's going to possibly affect, you know, your viewpoint. You might think, well, if you're only watching Fox News and getting your news off Facebook, maybe your viewpoint might be, well, the world's definitely unfriendly and there's not enough resources out there. So we should probably stop having kids altogether. And, you know, you might fall into the antinatalist.
Oh, geez.
Wait, before we go to the antinatalist, I want to talk about commission and omission.
Okay,
let's do it. Yeah, I think I got ahead of us. I think the antinatalist stuff is in the next chapter.
We're talking about commission omission right now. So I think, like, and I've been thinking about this a lot, and I'm not even convinced that I'm right, but, like, I think, you know, by and large, we're over the period of, like, actively engaging in crimes of commission to the degree that it's, like, happening hugely, because we don't have significant amounts of empirical wars where we're fighting to redefine the boundaries of territories. Like, there's some stuff going on in Russia and the Ukraine, and there's a few areas in the Middle East that have some problems, and, you know, like, there are some spots that are still, like, actively, you know, fighting to the death to build a town or to get the resources that their town needs or to declare the sovereignty of their nation. But, like, especially in North America, like, we didn't do it very well. And in fact, right now, we're in an age where the media is broadcasting the crimes of commission that did develop the borders in these lands. But that's sort of a lens to the past. And looking, and it's very confusing to me that someone would be upset with what's been committed and not be proposing to make their own nation, and in fact just want to continue to be a part of the nation that committed these tragedies, and they'd like to be paid more. I'm a young, stupid, ignorant child who has no idea and needs to read 100 more books and get an 8-year degree to be able to have anything to say about any country that is talking about colonial history and what to do about it now. I'm not the expert, but I think that, you know, barring that, we're in the age of omission, and we're looking at companies now that aren't being sustainable, and they're getting blasted. Like, remember that Volkswagen documentary for the carbon emissions? Like, there's a bunch of stuff happening that companies aren't doing, and they're not looking at, and they're hiding in the fog. Like, this notion of maybe we should get to a place where we can provide natural, clean, drinkable water to everybody on the planet, and not price gouge in order to do it. But, like, that's a big meta industry problem of transport and purification and stuff like that. But it doesn't mean that we can't be looking at it. And I think that, you know, you walk out your front door in a lot of neighborhoods and you're not at a high rate of being raped, murdered, or robbed. And, you know, obviously there's some areas where it's different, but I think post-Roman Empire till now, things were a lot worse. And pre-Roman Empire, things were pretty bad. I'd like to think that in the Roman Empire, aside from the fringe territories that were getting invaded and taken over, like, I think in the metropolises, crime was probably at around where we're at now again.
Yeah, but they had worse plagues. I mean, COVID-19 yeah. doesn't have anything on the Antonine Plague of Marcus Aurelius's time.
Yeah, and our health is just like, our health industry and our technologies have come so far that we're at a point where, you know, we're doing everything we can to get everybody to a higher, excellent level of existence, and we're addressing all of this multi-headed hydra of existence and sustainability and happiness, that there's so much to be missed because we're shooting at so many targets, and for as many as we're hitting, we're missing probably 10 times as many. But I think that those rates have increased over time, historically, to the point where we can say, but we're hitting a lot more targets.
Yeah.
Overall, though, Will, would you say that, I guess, on a cultural level, you know, between the benevolent king and the tyrant, are we still, or it was our past in kind of this more towards the tyrannical end of the spectrum, and compared to where we are now, do you see us more towards the benevolent end of the spectrum?
I think it's depends on the context, right? Like, depends who's telling the story too.
Yeah, I think it's like the stronger the empire, the more they believe in the wise king element. Like, we talk about Julius Caesar like, you know, he's a dictator. He was this terrible authoritarian. But back in the day, they loved him. And that's what, you know, held their culture together. Like, Caesar was their god, basically. So,
well, Caesar was also into acting, the drama arts, and tragic plays. So that's where he gets most of his inspiration from.
But to go back to your question, Jason, it's funny because, you know, I think I feel like the country feels a lot like I do, and I don't think there's any way for you to feel any other way about the world, you know, and hopefully that people can start to feel a bit better about themselves. But the way I feel at this point in my life is like, there's a lot of stuff that I'm now aware of that I'm doing wrong, and there's a lot of stuff that I'm now aware of that I'm doing right, and it's terrifying thinking about just how much energy and consistency is required to maintain the structure and improve it and move forwards. And that's kind of what democracy feels like right now to me. That's kind of what the world feels like to me right now. Like, we have so much more awareness. We probably don't even see all 999 channels yet. Like, there's still mini series on ethnic groups and disenfranchised peoples that we don't even know that we should know. And we're now addressing and tuning in and turning up and hopefully improving everywhere we can, but there's just as many people freaking out about just as many things that it's... If you get lost and you forget where all the happy stuff is, you can shrink that lens real quick.
And yeah. Not to mention that there are different narratives of the same channel, too, based on whatever they're broadcasting.
Right. And then there's the French channels. Jeez. The pay-per-views. Yeah, like, the exclusive content.
I read this report about, you know, who translates the work sort of dictates the new narration, right? And so if, you know, historically we've had male translators of all of these ancient texts, it's like, so there's now a telephone game. And if you had a female translator or, you know, another option of translator, anybody other than just white men
right.
for 5 minutes, you'd get different stories. And so now it's like the shows that you think you know were actually just a gender swap. You thought the Ghostbusters were men in the first movie, but in fact, in the original Greek, they were men and women. And there was 12 of them. But the translator thought that wouldn't read well on the movie.
Oh, the original Avengers? You mean Jason and the Argonauts?
But we cling to our stories because that's how we make sense of the world. But we have to be able to cling to the unclingingness too.
So in this story, he only gives us two options between the individual. You can be a hero or an adversary, but there's another idea of the nine archetypes or the nine alignments. How do you guys see that as fitting into this story at all? Does it fit in?
True neutral doesn't exist. It's just a lie.
But I took a quiz and it said I was true neutral.
Congratulations, you're a sociopath.
That's because you want to be true neutral. It's like the sorting hat got put on his head and he's like, please true neutral, please true neutral, please true neutral. And then the quiz gave him true neutral because that's what he truly wanted. That's all.
And it's like,
is.
Guess what? When the saber-toothed tiger shows up, you're not going to be true neutral.
Yeah.
True neutral on paper.
Like, I think they're really good for creating a Dungeons & Dragons character. I don't know if they're so great for defining real people. Like, I think everybody's going to have an element of chaos and lawfulness to them. Like, unless you see yourself as, like, the pure Ubermensch, then you're really not pure chaos. It really exists on a spectrum, to use an overused term.
No, that kind of makes sense. Great word.
But it's like, oh man, Jason, I lost my thought.
We were talking about a spectrum.
Well, who wasn't?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I think you are right, Scott, because somebody that might be described as chaotic, evil, or demonic, they're not like that 100% in every aspect of their way. They might have a little bit of lawful neutralness in them somewhere, right?
Well, it's like, so our interpretation of neutral and evil and good comes through a lens through which we've learned the world. And so you can never really dissociate from your own learnings and experiences to a degree that you could even conceptualize of neutral, right? Like, you aren't neutral, therefore you cannot see it.
You know what that kind of reminds me of? I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but there's an episode of Futurama where Zap Brannigan is describing all of the aliens in relation to Earth, like whether they're allies or they're enemies. He's just like, so you have the bad guys, they're the bad guys. You have the good guys, they're the good guys. But you can't... The one people I don't trust more than anybody else is the neutral, because you can never tell what the neutrals are really thinking. And then it like cuts off to this clip of like one of the neutral aliens dying in like a war scene, and like his buddy is like cradling his like dying body, and he's just saying, "If I die, tell my wife hello." And then he dies. And that stuck with me for the rest of my life. Like, ever since that point, I've just been like, can't trust true neutral. Zap Brannigan was right.
Well, it's almost like you're waiting to choose a side when you're neutral, I feel like.
And that's a problem, too. Because people will give you something. They will give you a side that they want. Unless you speak up.
Well, law is so weird, right? Like, in a lawful society, you have the right to privacy and you have freedom of speech. And so you don't have to, like, so you don't have to tell someone if you've been vaccinated or not. You don't have to tell someone what happens behind closed doors if there's no noise that sounds disturbing and probably causing. You know, like, you have, with law, the ability to obscure to the degree that it is okay according to law, and that is constantly in flux, and it's so bizarre.
And it goes deeper into like the idea of having like a, well, like, you can go deeper into the idea of lawful versus chaotic, because it's not necessarily that you're following the law of the time like you say it will, but like you're following your own moral code kind of thing. Like, I would argue that the guy from Jupiter's Legacy, you know, Sheldon Sampson, the utopian, is a perfect example of lawful good, because he's lawful to the max, because he prizes his law above anything else, which is, we don't govern, we don't kill, you know. But it's not the law. He holds himself above that law, but that's still a manifestation of lawful good, because he holds to a code. Whereas chaotic would be like, you wouldn't be able to predict anything that he does, because nothing has any like morals or virtues or plan behind it. He's not really aiming towards anything, just having fun in the moment, doing what's expedient, not what is meaningful, you know what I mean?
So, through that lens, who would be like a neutral?
A true neutral?
In Jupiter's Legacy. Not that you guys are in the loop.
Well, I'd say Brandon in the book is definitely chaotic. I'd say like someone who's true neutral would have to be someone with a code that follows a code or a law but struggles with it. So probably Grace might be neutral good. Does that track?
What about, what's the other guy's name? The one that I love with the eggs?
George. Sky Fox.
Is he neutral until, you know, reality shows up and then he has to make a choice?
He might be a good example of neutral, because pretty much everything he does is an expedient choice, because he's not forced to make that critical decision until, you know, he only has one egg on the table.
Well, so to bring it back to the podcast, like, neutral is, in my opinion, something that, you know, is afforded as a luxury to someone who doesn't have to actually face reality, right? Like, when the dragon comes to your door, you're not neutral. Like, you're not anything until, you know, nature shows up and gives you an ordeal. And when crisis hits, you're not going to be neutral. It's just not going
to
happen.
It's hard to even define neutral, because like, you either have a code or you don't. So you're either lawful or you're not. So like, true neutral would have to be like, you're just struggling with a code and to relate it back to George, I'm not sure if he really has a code at all. So he might be chaotic. He might be the perfect chaotic good character of that show.
Yeah.
Whereas Walter is just probably lawful evil. Or maybe neutral evil or chaotic evil. It's really hard to tell. It could go both ways, I think. Because we've talked.
Is there anything else you want to talk about of Rule 11 before we move to the last rule?
Yeah.
Well, I think what we're talking about, you know, kind of where you as a character and individual find yourself, or you might falsely identify, like myself, as a true neutral. But this is really kind of the topic of the last rule. You know, why should you be good? Why shouldn't you just be the Mephistopheles in life?
Well, and we're like, it leads in quite well from Rule 11. Like, it's a whole bunch of thou shall nots that relate to, you know, if you're not doing that, you should be doing grace at that point. If you're not arrogant or deceitful, like, you should be graceful in spite of your suffering.
Yeah, it's kind of like the laws of human nature in a way, where, you know, once we understand ourselves,
laws of human nature.
Oh yeah. That and referencing another book. But I guess it just, if we understand ourselves and know that we're going to suffer in life, then that gives us an opportunity to find something that will prepare us and give us a bit of, you know, for lack of a better word, hope down the line in our future. Figure out what we want to do and then just go for it.
Right, but like the on the opening page, there's this photo of Saint Sebastian, and I can't imagine that he had any hope other than he thought he was doing the right thing in telling the kings of the time, you know, that Jesus was the savior or whatever his message was. I don't exactly know, but he got shot up by a bunch of arrows, and then he didn't quite die from that. And so he, I guess, is this image for being grateful in spite of your suffering, because he suffered quite a bit, and it turns out that he ends up going back to mock the same king that shot him full of arrows, who then beats the guy up, and they dump him into like a sewer. And that's kind of the end of him. But I mean, he ultimately was doing what he thought was right.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that what he was doing was graceful, right? Like in the latter, when he returns, like, haha, you can't even kill me. Like that's not graceful.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, true.
But it's like, it's a question of, are you actually aware of the reality? Do you accept it? And are you going to say good? Or are you going to say bad? The reality, it's happening, right? Like, thing happens. Do you want to react well or poorly? Do you want to be outraged at the thing? Or do you want to deal with the thing? Like, there's two options.
And it would seem that one of those options, saying that it's bad, is almost like shutting down, saying, no, I'm not accepting this reality. Whereas the opposite, if you say yes, and you're open-minded to what might happen, kind of the what Jordan's saying, he's more optimistic than he is pessimistic, because ultimately he feels that being optimistic is the better of the two.
Yeah, I think it boils down to, one is blaming the world for everything, and one is just accepting all the, you know, the baloney that comes your way.
Or not even believing that the world is even real, right? Like, I feel as though And maybe I'm making this all up, but I feel as though our generation, Jason, asks the question, oh, really? More than who, what, when, where, why. And it's like, you know, you say something, like, I've just told you something that's going on in my life, and your response is, oh, really? It's like, that's not continuing the conversation. Your shock at my delivery of news does not further this exchange of intellectual ideas and experiences. Like, how about we get more data and go from there? But instead, it's like, you know, you get pulled over by a cop and you go, really? Yes. Yes, really. This is happening. You're experiencing it right now. So what are you going to do about it? Are you going to pretend that it's not happening? You're going to be shocked that it's not happening, be miffed and thrown off? Like, just embrace the present moment. Be here now. Get more data.
Yeah, I think the oh really response is kind of a way of denying its actuality.
Like a cop out. Wow, amazing. So cool. Like, this isn't doing anything for me. Like, oh, and how did that feel? Oh, and what was it like in that? And oh, when was this? Like,
yeah. There's definitely better ways to progress a conversation than, oh, okay, cool.
Maybe that's kind of the neutral way of responding. Like, they don't want to take a side. They're not willing to risk anything. So they'll just say, oh, okay, really?
But it can't be neutral because I find it so darn negative.
Maybe that's your problem.
I think it's a sin of omission. They're not intentionally committing it, but they are. And they should, like, that's a sin nonetheless. And it's a blind spot. And it's an opportunity for growth and openness. And to realize that this exchange that you're having, that you find pointless, that's taking up 45 seconds of your life, you're doing this 40 times a day. And you're going to do it every day for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And the things that repeat, that's life.
And as your parents always told you, like, anything that you do is worth doing right. So something that you're doing 40 times a day, that's worth putting some effort in to do properly, for sure. Absolutely.
Like, it's intention setting, right? Like, how many conversations do you have where before the conversation starts, you set your intention? This is something that you learn how to do in door-to-door sales, something that you learn how to do in mindfulness courses. It's something that you learn how to do when you get any self-help, really. But we don't do it. We don't go into a conversation and be like, okay, I'm going to be grateful. I'm going to go in with a point. I'm going to have a boundary. Like, there's a whole bunch of data and technology we can bring into every interaction we have. And we just show up and we wing it. And we're like, how you do anything is how you do everything. If you're winging it through your conversation and you're saying, oh, really? Like, I'd hate to see the kind of sandwich you make. I mean that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, in a way, it's kind of like what you're getting at is like acting nobly. Like, you can act nobly in a conversation and be engaged, or you can kind of shut down and put up these barriers, like you're saying, you know, quick, meaningless responses, essentially. And acting nobly is something that he addresses in this book. And he's kind of getting to the point that whatever you do, however you respond, it's going to have consequences. So if you choose to shut down a conversation, that's going to have a consequence, versus the opposite is true. If you know, pull the thread on a conversation, see where it goes, see where it leads you to.
Yeah, and you're going to find out that there's a lot of short threads in a lot of people's conversation ability. Like, this is something we need to do culturally and globally to have more meaning in our lives in every interaction. Because, like, don't get me wrong, I get it. You've got your best friends, if you're lucky. You know, millennials apparently only have maybe 25% of us a friend. But, you know, hopefully you've got like 3 to 6 people in your life that on a yearly basis you do an event with. On a quarterly basis, you see for some sort of like capitalist exchange of meal or beverage and conversation and catch up. Maybe on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, there's someone that you do things with. And hopefully, you know, a couple times a month, you're able to get lost in a conversation with those people. I'm not saying that you need to be my best friend, but I am saying that the average human with the psychotechnology and the technology of literacy and Facebook, they're able to have thousands of conversations every week, and they're doing a poor job. They're freaking out. They're reacting. They're shocked that people are reacting when they go on Facebook and they say something that's volatile. They don't even know what volatile things are. Like, we can do better.
Yeah, and I don't remember where I heard this. I think it was John Vervaeke, but there's a difference between a friend and a buddy. You know, a buddy is someone that you enjoy doing things with. A friend is someone you can connect with on a, like, a real emotional level. Like, it's good to have buddies. You need buddies, you know, like, go fishing or go play Magic the Gathering or some video games for a weekend, you know. That's important, but, you know, it's also important to have, like, meaningful, actual conversations about some of the questions that you're having in life. If you're going through a crisis, it's handy to have someone to, you know, lean on every once in a while.
And that kind of goes back to the idea of storytelling, because those conversations, those connections have real meaning to them. They help develop progress in moving the story forward.
Well, and it's like, you know, you hear it a lot, life isn't a game, you know, you're not in a movie. And it's like, well, if you were, first of all, it'd be a terrible movie, and you'd be losing the game, and you'd be like the most unimportant NPC ever, and I would never come to your shop.
Yeah, and worst of all, I mean, what do you have to offer?
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, if you are having a conversation, do you want the conversations in your life to be good? You are doing an action. Do you want the action to be great? Like, do you want date night to be half-assed, or do you want it to be filled with motion and color?
Right, but I do kind of feel there are some prerequisites that need to be filled in order for that person to be in the kind of integrated state to have a conversation, because you could be completely falling apart and the last thing you want is, you know, to talk about, you know, your life with a friend or a buddy. You know, you have to be kind of willing to voluntarily accept and transcend your suffering, you know, recognizing the person you're talking to likely is also going through their own suffering, and that kind of helps, I think, facilitate bringing out a dialogue.
Well, and the sneaky thing too is, like, you could, you know, have a terrible, miserable, unfortunate existence and really love, like, specific random topic and find that community on the internet, and you could just go and talk with some random person on Tumblr or Reddit or some other random comment thread in the internet.
Start a Discord server.
And you could get lost for 2 hours, and you'd be like, wait a second, I thought everything was terrible. This has been a great conversation. This is a great lo-fi track. Like, maybe I need more of this in my life.
Yeah. I thought people were garbage, but it turns out they're just like me. I think I have a good quote to tie in from this book, and it's the human race has been dealing with loss and death forever. We are the descendants of those who can manage it. So, you know, it doesn't matter what we're dealing with. Our ancestors have dealt with it already.
This, like, is the chapter also where he brings up the idea that, you know, if things are falling apart around you, the importance of standing up and bearing that responsibility of maybe saying a few nice words at a funeral, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, there's people like chaplains that I think do a lot of work behind the scenes when people are ending their getting to, you know, the end of their life. And you might not have your best friend around you, but at least there's these chaplains that they can, you know, they'll talk with you, and they're very sincere and genuine and kind people.
Mm-hmm. And that just goes back into, you know, acting nobly in the face of suffering, because like once you see the people that interact with death on a daily basis because it's part of their career, like the nurses that Jordan brings up, or the chaplains, and like they're around death constantly, and yet they don't fall apart, they don't completely break down, they're still, you know, like shining beacons of the human race, they're still good people. And it's just, there's some inspiration to be drawn from that, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, every person suffers, and he brings it up that we can transcend that suffering. But when he was writing this, his own wife was dying of cancer, I believe. And the question kind of that is subliminal in this chapter is like, why not fall into resentment and to the adversarial mind state, you know, given how cruel this world can feel? Like, why should we act nobly? That's the question that it felt was most prominent in this chapter, and maybe in the whole book.
I think the trouble with saying the world is cruel is that then it feels like you live in a cruel world. But it's a lot easier to say there has been cruel in the world.
I think the right response is yes, and... It's cruel, and it's also beautiful.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, as soon as you get stuck and say, look, one thing equals all truth, it's like, well, all right.
Yeah, like we go back to chapter 11. You're right, there is an authoritarian tyrant of culture, but there's also the wise king. So, you know, if you only dwell on that one aspect of culture and the one aspect of nature, you're going to have a bad time. You're going to focus on those, like the world is made of what you focus on, right? That's what we discovered at the beginning of this podcast.
Well, and then the other takeaway from the great stories, right, is that there is the arc of redemption for the adversary, and the right. Learning there isn't like, oh, well, adversary should become hero. It's like, am I in this person's story? Am I part of their redemption arc, or is that something completely out of my control? Because if you don't understand and have the appreciation, because you can't know all of these things, you can't fully understand, you can't say, oh, I know what your suffering is, oh, I am you, I fully understand the way you interpret reality, because you don't. But you have to be able to appreciate it, and you have to be able to understand your own experience, which is something that many of us, for myself, I certainly don't understand the implications of my own experiences yet. But it's like, you have to hopefully have a deeper understanding of your own and be able to see where you are and where your boundaries are, because if you're not in the redemption arc, you're wasting everybody's time.
And also, if you're not a part of someone's story and you're in a world of confusion, can you be redemptive? Can you find ways of redeeming yourself within the anonymous world?
Mm-hmm.
Starts by stepping out of your own cave.
Right. And like, the more I think about it, the more I really like Jordan Peterson's formulation of like those seven archetypes. Like, if you're really just swimming in chaos, then like you need a little bit of the fairy godmother. I also kind of see like a dichotomy in like the will to power and agape, like I've been hung up on lately, like you guys know. Like if you take the wise king and the authoritarian tyrant together, and then you take the fairy godmother and the evil queen together, they could both kind of represent that, you know, that agopic creation in the individual and that will to power spark type creation in the individual as well. So I think like a big part of the individual is just being shaped by culture and nature in that way. Like parts of nature will affect you in the ways of agape, and parts of it will inspire you. Like, you know, sometimes you'll see a sunrise and you'll think, ah, there is a God, life is beautiful. Sometimes you'll see a sunrise or just look at the trees and be inspired to paint it or something. You know what I mean? I think that's the two different attributes of nature affecting the individual. But it always comes down to that choice of, am I going to act on it, or am I just going to listen to the adversary? Am I going to take the path of the hero, or am I just going to let the adversary stop me and go down the unrighteous path, or the uninspired path even?
Right, and I think it's important to take the opportunity in every moment that you can to take that more benevolent path, because he points out that as we age, we start to become more particular in our ways and our behaviors. So if you are constantly taking the wrong path when you're 60 years old, what path do you think you're going to be, you know, way down into the dark forest in? But if you're choosing the right path now, it's possible you're going to choose that in the future, and hopefully when you do reach that future self of yours, you will be on a better grounding, a more lit path.
A brighter
illuminated
path.
I am thankful for this book. I didn't find it to be a sequel of the same medium. I think that 12 More Rules had a lot less than 12 More Rules. But it was good. There was some good story. And I think that's probably the point, right? Rules can only get you so far. You need to pontificate a bit more than just dictate.
Yeah, I really liked the first two chapters and the last two chapters, and there was a lot of, you know, extra Bible stuff in the middle that, you know, I could have, you know, take it or leave it kind of thing for me, but I think it's pretty good. After finishing it, like, when I was caught in the middle, I was worried that I, like, wouldn't really like it as much, but at the end, I think it's good. It belongs on the bookshelf right beside the first one here.
Well, I think whether or not he's gone full in on, you know, the Christian path or viewpoint, I think there is a significant aspect there of sacrificing some of your own self and not always thinking about yourself, and kind of putting some of your energy into cultivating a spirit, so you're not like, you don't have a poverty of the spirit, and thinking about your fellow man, that I think goes a long way if you don't want to necessarily believe in a God. But I think this book was quite different than the first book, and I thought it provided a lot more colorful quotes. There was a lot of material in this book that kind of felt like a philosophical treatise. why to be good, why not to be a nihilist, whereas the first book was more instructional.
This one almost felt like a response to Sam Harris in that kind of sense, like the amount of Jesus smuggling he had to do, and like the whole moral landscape thing that Sam Harris talks about. And that was one of Jordan Peterson's biggest problem with Sam Harris's ideology and all of his work, is like, you don't define good at all except for well-being, and that's not nearly good enough. Humans are complex, okay? You can't just boil it down to well-being, because, you know, what's well-being for one is not well-being for another. So you've contradicted yourself already.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I'm kind of on the same side as Scott. The first couple of rules and the last few rules were really, really good to read. I've especially enjoyed the one where he mentions cleaning up, or not clean up, well, make one room in your home as beautiful as possible. And he brings up the ideas of the arts and everything like that. That was really, that was probably the only chapter in the book that I've meditated on the most. Because, you know, as an artist myself, I always look for ways to bring about something that is magnificent in the most unlikely ways, or, you know, bringing a character to do something unpredictable, or describing a scene in different ways from different viewpoints and everything like that. And it's also been really good to explore the ideas of memory and bringing out what you have been through, what you remember, what you find to be a mystery, what are some moments from your life that are still hidden and you're just trying to figure that out. And just bringing that through the ideas of rejection and criticism, and just, you know, putting it all into practice, that can definitely transform your vision and what you see in the world. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, like an epic or anything like that. It could just start off small, like, you know, like a room here, or what you see throughout the window, or in a way that you can see, you know, kind of like in the movie Rear Window, where James Stewart, the actor, stuck in a wheelchair, and all he does is just look at other people's apartment windows and see what their world is like. So.
Yeah, it might be something as small as just saying in this very moment, you know, this is good.
Life is good. It's cool to have one.
Good.
Well, I think we've just about covered it. So, until next time. Hail Lobster!
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.
May the force be with you.
Beautiful.